The press, I wonder, just what do you think about the role of the major press, the media in the United States, in effectively condoning and allowing, without much serious criticism, this year, this election and recent elections, this condoning the situation where this private commission gets to display the debates, broadcast them through the media, through that same broadcast media, and by thereby limit the discourse? What do you think? What would you do about that?
Well, there's a lot that we would do. One thing we would do would be to abolish that that commission. We believe that commission is in fact a phony commission that reflects the monopoly power of the two parties and their main objective, which is to maintain their monopoly and to exclude real political challenges. So we would definitely do away with that. But it's not really surprising that the most of the corporate media would go along with this this position. This is seen as a responsible and mature position, and because of the orientation of this largely white male media industry, very few real critical questions are raised regarding the role of that commission and the fact that this arbitrary 15% for support from these five polls creates a catch-22 for any third-party candidacy. So we challenge that. We will continue to take that to the American people and challenge that control.
Is the Green Party and the Libertarians cooperating on any legal challenge?
No, well, we wanted to have some type of there was, in fact, a legal challenge that the Green Party launched, and we have been trying to cooperate with the Libertarians, but we have not had much success with that. But the point I want to make real quickly is that if we would not have been excluded, if Jill Stein would have had a chance to stand next to Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, two of the most distrusted, disliked candidates in the history of politics in the U.S., not only will we have been competitive, we stood a good shot of winning this thing. And the same thing with the vice presidential debates. Now, we have had to go around the monopoly and create a way in which we can, in fact, interact or debate these candidates by using social media. And that's what we did with Dr. Stein. We had a people's debate, if you will, that was done almost in real time, where she was able to respond to the same questions that were posed to Trump and to Hillary Clinton. And we were able to touch almost 15 million people as a consequence. And the same thing happened with the vice presidential debate, sponsored primarily by Democracy Now. We had I had a chance to respond to those same questions, and we had 5 million people who saw that debate and still counting. And many people who saw it said that, in fact, I won that debate. So, that's the potential we have if we were able to penetrate this corporate media, that we would be real contenders and could probably in 2016 brought about a historic upset.
I, for one, of course, would love to see you, Ajamu Baraka, in a debate up against, for example, Pence, Trump's running mate, and Tim Kaine, Hillary Clinton's running mate. It would be fascinating. It would be educational. People can go and watch that extra debate that was created, using the web access, the virtual media and delivered to you. And we broadcast it on this station as part of Democracy Now, that we are weekdays on this station. And people can find more of that at democracynow.org. You can go and listen to those presidential and vice presidential conversations immediately following the presidential debates, from which the Green Party and Libertarian Party were excluded. Just Ajamu Baraka, in the limited time we have, I want to ask you particularly about a criticism of your running mate Jill Stein that's out there. She, of course, is a medical doctor. She's worked as an activist and educator around the connection between human beings' health and the quality of their local environment. She has deep local roots around Massachusetts. She protested the Filthy Five coal plants in Massachusetts. She's was on the board of the Boston Chapter for Physicians for Social Responsibility. She did a lot of local activism, founded and served as co-chair of the Lexington Town Solid Waste Action Team. That committee was approved by the Lexington Board of Selectmen. They were featured in a textbook called Approaches to Sustainable Development, the Public University and the Regional Economy. In other words, she's been active not only as a medical doctor and incidentally an instructor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, practiced internal medicine 25 years at Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital and other hospitals, Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare and others. And then she was able to retire and started working tirelessly, especially on environmental issues, has won awards from Clean Water Action and other organizations. She really has been creative and tireless as an activist in her own town of Lexington in Massachusetts and nationwide, and now as a presidential candidate for the Green Party. The reason I bring all that up is to give people a sense of her gravitas, because when I speak to progressives and left-leaning people I know, one of the first things out of their mouths, women even, say, well, she doesn't sound presidential, or she comes across as too lightweight or something. And I mean, for one thing, it's astounding that the sexism in that, I have to say, but what's it been like for you working with Jill Stein? And what do you think? What do you think of that positioning that Jill Stein's receiving?
Pure nonsense. I mean, it's been a pure pleasure working with Dr. Stein. Dr. Stein is one of the other things that has cropped up from time to time is that Dr. Stein is supposed to be anti-science. Well, I could tell you, Dr. Stein is a science nerd. I mean, for her, evidence-based research is primary, and she is one of the hardest working and most prepared persons I've ever worked with. And the notion that she is not well prepared or heavy enough to take on the burdens of governance is absolute nonsense. When you subject yourself to this process, and you have to go in front of critical audiences, from Fox News to you name it, if you don't have your stuff together, it would be quite obvious. But in every instance, she has shown to be grounded in the facts, to have a vision that transcends the visions of both those two other candidates, and is quite clear to most people who look at her objectively that she has the gravitas, the ability to, in fact, govern in this country. So that's all distractions coming from primarily we see Democrat supporters, and we don't really take that seriously.
Democratic supporters, but also people, commentators in the press who are considered very liberal, even in the Boston area media, people who are taken seriously. I want to put this to you because Green Party seldom has a chance to respond to this, but let me put this to you that broadcast commentators in greater Boston are saying and pointing out that Jill Stein should step aside, let someone else, well, four other people at least ran against her for the nomination in the primary in the Green Party, but let someone else run, as they put it, Hillary Clinton, step aside, let someone else run. Anyway, I've heard that criticism. I've also heard, and I'd like you to address this, Ajamu Baraka, specifically, Jill Stein has not won an elected office, not in the town of Lexington, not among the selectmen. She's focused on education and activism and making change where she sees it as being most powerful instead of entering politics through the traditional establishment entryways that some other people get in. Well, people like Ross Perot didn't get in that way. Lots of other people didn't get in that way. But I want to hear you address this criticism that Jill Stein's never won elected office. How could she possibly be a serious contender or know how to run the presidency of the United States?
Well, you know, one thing we need to do is to demystify governance here in this country. If you have a lifetime of service, if you have the kind of background that Jill Stein has, the ability to manage people, to understand budgets, to understand the world, and have common sense, then you can definitely govern in this country. And it's quite interesting to me that people would raise that kind of question after we had George Bush. Come on, that's not a serious position. So, you know, the kind of a background that Jill Stein has I think, uniquely qualifies her to run this country. And being an outsider is, in fact, an advantage. One doesn't have to go up the ranks of opportunist politics here in the U.S. To be prepared to, in fact, govern. If you have common sense, if you have the ability to bring in people who are good, who have the background and the areas that you need to govern, that's all you really have to have here in this country, in my opinion. So we reject those kinds of arguments, and we understand why many of these liberal commentators are making those arguments, because they are, in fact, devoted and committed to the Clinton machinery. But we say that the Clinton machinery brings nothing more but status quo politics, politics that the American people are prepared to reject, politics that are leading us to war. So no matter how heavy Hillary Clinton is supposed to be, she has a political position that we believe will be devastating in the future if she, in fact, wins that office.
Jamu Bracha, just curious to ask, you've been based in and worked in Colombia in recent years. There's no time to go into lots of detail, but what's your work there?
I was basically supporting the work of my partner, who is a human rights activist and organizer with the black communities in Colombia, who's been very much part of the peace process that is ongoing, unfolding here in this country. Primarily writing and providing support for her, but still going back and forth to the U.S., which is my main theater of operation politically. I've been doing this, you know, for a few years, being in Colombia and supporting the work of the movement in Colombia and really throughout Latin America.
Trick question, totally unprepared. Paramilitaries in Colombia, how are they significant? Are they significant still? All the press coverage has been on the failure of the FARC, left-wing rebels, and the government of Colombia to reach a peace deal. What about the role of paramilitaries?
There's a real concern on the part of activists on the continuation of the power of paramilitaries, that even with an agreement between FARC and the government, that issue of their growing power has to be addressed. In the black communities, their main issue or main concern is less with FARC than it is with the growing power of the paramilitaries connected to corporations and powerful individuals in Colombia, and in some ways still supported by elements of the government. So that will be an ongoing issue in Colombia, even with a peace accord. It is as important as this peace accord really would be for the sufferings and the victims here there in Colombia.
Trick question, what is Aleppo?
Aleppo is a major city in Syria that is now contested between the so-called rebels and the Syrian government. There is now a thrust being made to create some kind of humanitarian corridor to relieve the suffering of the people in Aleppo. We also understand that if that battle is concluded, then there's a real possibility that if there's real integration back into the Syrian governmental control, that might be the thing that might be needed to begin to move toward a real serious consideration of peace in Syria. So we hope that the people are relieved, but we also hope that there's a real movement toward a peaceful settlement in Syria.
And Jamu Bracha, just perhaps time for a very final question. What do you make of the recent ceasefire that was broken by including the United States, which bombed Syrian and killed Syrian army government soldiers? The United States claimed it did so mistakenly. Russia then backed what appears to have been the Syrian army bombing and attacking a United Nations led aid caravan to people in desperate, desperate need of that humanitarian aid. The ceasefire fell apart. What do you think of that?
I think it's unfortunate that the ceasefire did, in fact, fall apart. It was almost doomed from the start, because one of the requirements was for the U.S. to use its influence to separate the so-called rebels from the al-Qaeda-linked rebels. And that was very, very difficult, if not impossible, since they are so interconnected. And it's unfortunate that bombing took place at Deir ez-Zor, that against a a unit that the U.S. was well aware was there in place. It's very hard to believe that was an accident. It's unfortunate that the aid convoy was bombed by whatever forces. It is really sad that all of this is unfolding because it was so unnecessary. And we call for all sides to cease with these war activities and to have a real thrust toward a political and diplomatic reconciliation in Syria, because it's clear that a military solution is not going to be achieved on either side. So we hope that there is a real effort on the part of the international community to finally put pressure on all forces to stop the commitment toward a regime change and to allow for a real national reconciliation to take place in Syria.
Final question, shifting gears super fast. What would you do? What kind of a plan might you implement to break up the big banks, as even the Texas Federal Reserve Regional Board of Governors has urged people to do in government?
Well, we think that we missed an opportunity with the crisis that was generated in 2008 to, in fact, do that. And so we think that, this is a position that we still have to iron out within the campaign in terms of how a breakup of the big banks will look in reality. But it's quite clear that banks that are too big to fail are also too big to be allowed to continue and have the kind of power that the banks have over the U.S. economy. I also believe that's my personal opinion, that we have to exercise a more democratic control over the Fed. Now, the position of the campaign is also in alignment with that. But I think that democratic control over the Fed needs to extend to complete control over the Fed. It doesn't make sense for private bankers to have that kind of power over our monetary policies. And so if we're going to have real independence, independence from the ruling element on behalf of the American people, we've got to put some real constraints on the financial sector in this country and this country that and really get the entire world, because we know that the financial elite based in the U.S. Represent the dominant financial elite globally.
Ajamu Baraka, you've been very gracious to our listeners, and on behalf of our listeners, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule and obviously your important work to deliver this message. Ajamu Baraka joined us from Colombia today. Ajamu, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
We spoke with Ajamu Baraka, the vice presidential candidate for the Green Party of the United States, running alongside candidate for president Jill Stein, based here in Lexington, Massachusetts. Ajamu Baraka is the only person of color among the current Democratic, Republican, and Libertarians all-white candidates. We did invite Libertarian vice presidential candidate and former governor of Massachusetts, William Weld, but he was unavailable today. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm John Grebe. You can tune to this program every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And a special thanks today to Sports Saturday for giving us the extra time for this important interview. Until 1:15, you can find our streams and archives of the last 2 weeks of our broadcasts linked from WZBC.org. We now have a selection of some of our interviews over the years available to listen to and summaries of them at soundsofdissent.org. That's www.soundsofdissent.org. Stay tuned to WZBC Newton 90.3 FM. And of course, remember,
any views on the program do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees.
The armed occupation of a national wildlife...
You are tuned to WZBC Newton 90.3 FM. Sports Saturday is up next.
All right. Well, we're here. Sports Saturday. Starting a little late today, but it's all right. Some great interviews with John Grebe. A lot going on in the political world, so totally understand extending that show. But today we got a lot to talk about. BC football last night had a interesting game, to say the least. Once again, I'm Connor Ollie here with Anthony Ayotti, Jake DiLorenzo. Jake and I were calling the game last night, and man, that got ugly early. How are you guys doing today post Clemson game, or whatever you want to call that? I would say a thrashing.
I have no emotion. I mean, what'd you expect, honestly, going into that game? And it's hard to really say if BC would even compete with Clemson, especially the way it's not 2 years ago where Boston College had really good competition. They right should have beat Florida State and Clemson that year, and they still went. What'd they go? I think they had 10-8 wins that year.
2014, 7-6.
7-6 that year, and probably should have been more like 9-4.
Well, should have won the bowl game, almost beat Clemson, like you said, almost beat Florida State that year, like you said, yes.
They should have, based on kicking and a drop pass.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all it was. And, I mean, their defense obviously hasn't been the same. I mean, they lost Stevens, they lost Simmons, they lost Wujiak, who was their leader on the line. So, I mean, I just didn't expect that game to get that out of hand. That's my main point to it.
Yeah, just so quick. They had the opportunity with that muff punt by Ray McLeod to get up 7-0 early and put it in the hands of the defense. And not only didn't they do that, but the defense that first quarter was as inept as I've seen a BC defense, I think, in my 4 years here. It's just giving up the big plays, not making tackles. We're talking, Jake, yards after the catch was absolutely ridiculous yesterday. It was all bad on the defensive side, except for that second quarter, I would say.
Yeah, I think the two ways you can kind of tell the story of that game. One, in the first half, BC making three trips inside the 25-yard line of Clemson and coming away with 3 points on those trips. You had the goal line stand by Clemson's defense when everyone in the stadium thought BC had broken the plane and gotten into the end zone on that second drive into the red zone. And at the end of the first half, the Patrick Toles questionable targeting play, which we can talk about, where he fumbles, Clemson recovers, BC wastes an opportunity there. That is one culprit, and the other would be the missed tackles, like you said. I mean, the play that sticks out in my mind, Connor, is when BC was trailing 14-3, and Clemson comes out, I think it was the first play of a drive after a pretty poor punt, and just throws a quick little curl route to Jordan Leggett, the tight end, and he just takes it all the way. Missed tackle by Cameron Moore, and missed tackle by really everyone on that defense, enabled Clemson to open that lead to 21-3. And from there, as a fan, I lost most hope in BC hanging in that game.
But then again, you didn't. The way the second quarter played out, BC drove down, I think it was 80 yards to the goal line, and came away with a turnover of downs. That was just so unfortunate. But if BC's defense was really shutting Clemson down the second quarter, I don't think Clemson was able to get.
But that's part of the problem. BC played a pretty good first half, or at least second quarter, and went into the half down by 18. You can't miss a single opportunity if you're going to beat a team like Clemson.
Well, yeah, as Connor and I were saying last night, along with Andrew Kelly, that in a team where you know you are not as great physically, you're not as great in terms of your speed, not as great even strategically, you're not as great.
Right.
I mean, Dabo Swinney is obviously, you know, it was a better football coach than Steve Addazio. No knock on him. It's just Clemson.
No one would dispute that.
Yeah, I don't think anybody would dispute that.
All right. It's just Clemson, BC we're talking here. So obviously, you know, you're outmatched in every single facet of the game, despite how good BC's defense has been. I mean, you're still not the same capability. You still don't have the same athletes. So you had to limit every single mistake possible. You couldn't make a mistake in order to win this game.
Right, exactly. And then BC wasn't able to capitalize to the fullest, like Connor mentioned, the muff punt.
I mean, I'm starting to tell. I mean, just did you expect Deshaun Watson to have a quiet game?
No, I didn't.
Like, not at all. I mean,
because no one has been able to stop him. Not BC's number one ranked defense last year.
Yeah.
They still gave up 34 points to him. Yeah, they intercepted him twice last year, but they gave up 34 points to him. You knew that barring some sort of miracle, Clemson was going to be scoring 30 points at least.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think what was so disheartening was just that it was so early for Clemson to get this one out of control. They were getting 21 points in the first quarter when they stalled their first drive and then had the muff punt. was just like,
and they
I have never
seen the first two possessions.
Exactly. Yeah, just how quickly it turned around for BC. Like, the game was over by the beginning of the second quarter. I know Jake and I were talking about while we were there on the broadcast, just to, you know, if they could convert something on that fourth and goal, if they could get in the end zone, if they could make a big play here or there, they might be able to get back in the game. But honestly, I didn't feel during any of that game after the first quarter that BC really had a chance in this one. And that's an unfortunate state of the program, just how we are right now, is that we aren't able to compete against high-level ACC competition at this particular point in time with our football team. It's the sad truth, but after the Virginia Tech game and last night's game, it's not only can't we win, but it looks like that we might get the doors blown off us on any ACC contest, which is unfortunate.
I mean, yeah, just everything is right about what you said. I mean, there's still hope in the year. Maybe this game will... I mean, you still have a bye week, so it's not like you can get down on the loss for too long. You have that bye week. You shouldn't anyway. I mean, you're playing Clemson. You have to understand that. I think Adazio has to tell the players, you have to understand we played a top three team in the nation.
But it's disheartening because of the way they've played these top five teams in the past.
Exactly.
They've always played
them well. The last 3 years, every time we've had a top flight team, whether it's Florida State, Clemson, or USC come into Chestnut Hill, it has been a one or two possession game each time. And that's what concerns me about the program, is that there seems to be a regression, because there haven't been that many injuries going into this year. The main loss was Don Brown. We got a quarterback in Tolles who, yeah, he struggled a little bit at Kentucky last year with the interceptions, but so far has played fine.
He's an upgrade.
Yeah, he is an upgrade from what we had last year. So to me, it doesn't bode well when you look like you're regressing to such an extent. I don't know if it's the fact that we're relying on young guys or if it's just the loss of some leaders like Justin Simmons, a lot of guys, especially in the running back court, transferring. I don't know exactly what it is, but there's a lot of fixing to do on this BC football team, and right now I'm not confident in their ability to make a bowl game.
I think it's Donnie Brown. I think that was the biggest loss.
Yeah.
I mean, just look at the way the defense has been. Donnie Brown, as we say it all the time, and, you know, I hate to say it, but that whole "to be a dude" thing, which was Adazio's real slogan for, the first couple of years of the school, that was Donnie Brown, apparently.
Yeah, he was the one who came up with that, and he's brought it to Michigan. I mean, they're using that stuff now, too.
And was the BC strength, and what was it, our sophomore years, 2 years ago? I mean, yeah, they had a great running attack, and they had a lot of trick plays on offense that threw off the defenses. That's why we won those games. But it was still the defense was the heart of that team. And even last year, imagine we had the offense of our sophomore year, or even this year's offense, with last year's defense.
Oh, we'd be a very solid team.
We would be solid team. Just that defense was unstoppable. Notre Dame, we had 6 or 7 turnovers that game.
Right.
Against I think Notre Dame was a top 3, top 5 offense in the country at that time.
Right.
So yeah, it just proves that. I think it really was Donnie Brown.
Yeah, we had like 5 or 6 turnovers in that Notre Dame game, single-handedly kept us in that game, and I completely agree with you.
With John Fadula as quarterback.
Yeah. I mean, what concerns me is going into this year, I really did think things would be different compared to 2015 when we went 3-9 winless in the ACC. And maybe that was foolish of me in hindsight. But I thought things would be different. I had hope. You know, let's be honest, this is a weak schedule that they're playing. Yes, they're always going to draw the tough ACC opponents, but I figured in a weak schedule, they could find 6 or 7 wins and get to a bowl game, regardless of what bowl game it is. And as we sit here now and we just kind of compare the 2 years, I was excited about the upgrade at quarterback, and he has been an upgrade. He has not been perfect. We can critique him at any time, but...
Best arm that we've had since Chase Redding.
And the offense has upgraded a little bit. But the step back that the defense has taken, whether you want to attribute it to Don Brown going to Michigan or the 3 or 4 guys we lost to the NFL, the step back the defense has taken really shocked me. I thought that they would still be a great defense. Maybe not number 1 or number 3 anymore, but I still thought we'd have maybe a top 10, top 20 defense in the country, and we haven't seen that.
I mean, because it shocks me, because their front 7 is still good. I mean, you have Truman Goodapple is still great.
Because what they lost in terms of players, they replaced
with
very good players.
If anything, this year's line is faster because you have Zach Allen.
I like Zach Allen
and Kavalek, and Landry's just so much better this year. I mean, compared to last year,
Landry had a great game last night. I thought the defensive line overall, especially against Watson, trying to contain him, did a pretty good job.
I mean, they threw a lot of quick passes, and the receivers just beat our secondary.
Yeah, the secondary, I think, is the biggest disappointment for me in, going into this season. I think our linebackers are can be very good in terms of tackling and defending
against linebackers.
Yeah,
and in Milano.
But the issue we saw with them and with our defensive backs and safeties is they can't compete that well against speed, like the speed that Clemson had. And they were in one-on-one coverage a bunch last night as we saw the defense. Reed was trying to get some blitzes going, five or six men rushes, and as a result, there was one-on-one coverage with a lot of the receivers. And as a result, you saw Mike Williams getting open. You just saw Clemson was able to take advantage with a lot of balls over the top and over the middle because BC can't do one-on-one coverage with their receivers.
No, I really do question the defensive game plan because Deshaun Watson is not the guy that you send these blitzes at. He's too good with his feet. He's too mobile. He's not a statue in the pocket who's going to succumb to the pressure. He's going to roll out and make plays with his feet.
No, what you need to do is you have to have your defensive ends set the edge and keep them in the pocket. And you have like four or so guys rush, and then I would go keep
the... They really weren't blitzing that much of the night.
Yeah.
It really was the front four only a lot for most of the... couldn't blitz, like you said, Anthony.
My biggest thing was the safeties weren't helping on the over-the-top throws. They had two 50-yard bombs that if we just had our safeties back, those plays shouldn't have happened. But we let them go into one-on-one coverage, and Clemson's going to take that all day. Watson was great with his touch passes last night.
You have Deshaun Watson, who could be a potential top 10 pick. And you have Mike Williams, who they're saying could be a potential top 10 pick. The guy's, I think, 6'4", 220. 215.
They've got tons of talent, man.
Like, they have two top 10 offensive players.
Wayne Gallman, Jordan Leggett. They've got some big name, premier names in college football on that offense.
I mean, exactly. Has an opportunity to be one of the best, maybe the best offense in college football.
They showed they could win a shootout with Louisville.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Lamar Jackson, look at the year Lamar Jackson's having. He's having a Heisman year.
Yeah. I think, guys, my biggest thing is what does this kind of game say about the program that 2 years ago we lost 17-13 to Clemson at home? Probably should have won the game if Tyler Rouse makes a big catch in the waning seconds as he's wide open. Then last year we go down to Death Valley. Anthony was there. I think we lost by 18.
Yeah, I think it was 34-17.
Yeah, 17 points. And then this year you're seeing a trend. We lose by 4 points, now by 17 points last year, and then this year 46 points against a team like Clemson. You see, like, it's almost two programs going in different directions when you look at a game like this and the progression that it's had over the last few years. And it doesn't look good for BC. Where do we go moving forward?
It's been really hard for me to get the taste of the 49-0 loss to Virginia Tech out of my mouth, and now we add on the Clemson game.
Well, that's why I was so not confident coming into this game, is because Virginia Tech, you've no business losing to them 49-0. Right. Zero.
It just shows, like you said, going in the wrong direction, and yeah, I think it's a major, major concern. You know, if BC had played that Virginia Tech game well, and we know they played the Georgia Tech game very close, unfortunately couldn't come away with a win, and they beat the teams they were supposed to beat in UMass, Wagner, and Buffalo. If all of that had happened, and they came out and got demolished by Clemson last night, I would say, okay, you know, they didn't play their best game, but they lost to a much, much, much better team. It happens. You know, we'll move on. But when you see this happen in back-to-back ACC games, one against a team that now is ranked 25th, but is not on the level of Clemson, it's really concerning. And I think the state of the program is really precarious right now. I think it's hinging on a couple of games this year. I think it's hinging on Syracuse, NC State, and Wake Forest. You can't go winless in the ACC again. You can't.
No, absolutely. I think if you go winless in the ACC, like, there has to be a change.
Changes
there absolutely has to be a change. I'm not one who's like, I don't like just calling for the head coach's head for the sake of calling for the head coach's head, but it's just like, it's unprecedented to go 0-16 in the ACC in two straight seasons. Like, I don't know how you can bounce back from that as a head coach. I just don't know how that happens.
Spot on. I mean, I think really the big loss, the big change happened a year ago, this past offseason.
Yeah,
a
Brown.
One.
Yeah.
Imagine if he was here still. I think
the head coach.
I think he was such a motivator for that defense last year because, like we mentioned before, the talent in the front seven for BC's defense is still the way it is this year. Sure, they lost. I mean, but really, their only big loss was Simmons last year in the secondary.
Yeah,
secondary. Yeah,
I mean,
and they got healthier too because at the end of the year they were playing, I think, without either Moore or Yiedem. I don't remember, but one of their two starting corners, and they got those guys healthy.
I mean, it was just Simmons, and granted, Simmons fourth round draft pick. I think
third round, won. Yeah,
third great round player. Draft pick. Very good so player. That is a big loss. Let's not discount that, but still, it is just one player, and you have just as talented as a front seven as you did last year, despite losing Stevens and
Wojak and Abdesmad.
Yeah, I mean, all three of those guys were great, but you still have Landry, you still have Kavlik, who both those guys I like.
Yeah, and Allen is just much faster, too.
Yeah, Allen made a few plays last night.
Wyatt Ray.
Wyatt Ray. Got it right.
He's a quick end, just like Landry is. A little undersized, but speed is what Landry's suit is, and so is Wyatt Ray. So, to me, it came down, and I keep beating on this, but it just drives me nuts right now. What it is, but it drives me absolutely nuts is that Donnie Brown really was that heart and soul, and he was that motivator.
Do you think?
I mean, Adazio was an offensive guy. He's supposed to be.
Do you think Brown coming in to the last offseason, he's a Northeast guy. If you look at his pedigree, he's from this area. He's coached a lot in this area. So do you think he had an inkling that this was a sinking ship, or do you think that it was just too good of an opportunity to go to Michigan?
I think too good of an opportunity, because how could you really see the ship sinking when offensively there was truly nowhere to go but up, and defensively it's not like the whole defense was leaving and there was no talent behind it. There was a couple key guys left, yes, but the talent behind it, we've seen step up.
Imagine Donnie Brown's packages with that front four that you could make into, like, I compare a giant NASCAR rush. I mean,
right.
You could have three edge rushers in there.
I just think you attribute it to the Michigan job and how glamorous and a great opportunity that is. And I don't know. I'm not discounting the loss of Don Brown, but I just don't think we can write this whole defensive collapse off on him leaving. I think it goes deeper than that, and maybe I don't really know what it is, but they did bring in a very reputable defensive coordinator in Jim Reed. They do have very good assistant coaches all across the rest of the staff, so I don't know how much of it is coaching. I do have some issues with the head coach, but
I mean, I feel like that makes it coaching, because the fact that you have the talent and you have your assistants, and that's going to go, that leads up to Adazio then. That just points it closer to Adazio.
But is it more of a problem of Don Brown leaving, or is it that Jim Reed maybe isn't putting the defense in as great of a position to succeed? Because I think Reed has a lot to work with.
He does. We kept mentioning.
Yeah, and I mean, he definitely has a lot to work with. I think coordinators are definitely an issue for BC, and they have been over the last couple of years. I think we have not nailed down a great offensive coordinator like in the last few years. The last time our offense looked decent to good was in the Tyler Murphy year.
With Ryan Day, who then left for the NFL.
Yeah, who left for the NFL. Day knew what he was doing. He knew how to set some guys in motion like Sherm Alston, knew how to cut loose Murphy and use his ability to throw touch passes. He played to the strengths of the offense.
Look at all the plays we ran that year.
Yeah,
you saw a couple last night.
No, but the great thing about that year, Day did a good job of, he set up plays, I think, that were designed to the opponent we were going to play. He shifted the BC offense throughout the entire year to play a game that was predicated on who our opponent was, which I thought was exactly how BC needs to play. They need to play to their opponent's weaknesses. We're not a good enough football team where we can just have a philosophy and just like run it down some other team's throat.
Right.
You have to adjust game to game.
It's not the Syracuse basketball 2-3 zone where,
yeah,
you know, come and get it. You're right. We need to tailor the game plan.
Yeah, so that is my thing with the offensive side of the ball, and I think defensively we sort of had that too. But to our point, I think that we still have a lot of the same guys from last year, especially in the linebacking core, have some good defensive linemen, and the secondary with John Johnson, who I thought is supposed to be maybe the ACC's best safety this year. I really thought we'd have the tools to be the same sort of defense, and really it doesn't look like that way this year. And a big part of it is giving up big plays. We've seen a big play given up in just about every game this year for BC.
True.
Multiple ones, too.
Do you think part of the problem on defense is that they're trying to live up to the expectation of that they are a top five defense, and maybe they're trying to do too much? Like, maybe a guy like John Johnson is just trying to create turnovers that maybe aren't there, and as a result, they're giving up big plays. I mean, do you guys see that being a part of the problem?
I mean, I just want to... Actually, I'm sorry. I mean, last night, though, I really didn't notice any gambling, though, by the defense. I just saw missed assignments. It really was more about that than, say, like a big gamble play, which cost for a big yard.
Which, and in a game like Clemson...
I mean, it was missed tackling, too. It's just bad tackling.
That, which, is to me, is more concerning. Because in a game like Clemson, you know, if defensively you decide you're going to take some gambles, that's okay with me. Because you're going to need... I can live with that. You're right.
I'd live sending a big blitz package on a big third down and just...
Yeah, you can...
A one-on-one coverage.
Exactly.
A big play. Can, I would live with that.
Exactly. I totally agree on that point. But when the problem is missing assignments, not playing disciplined football... In a game where you know you can't make any major mistakes, to me, that's much more of a concern.
Yeah, it's, once again, we talked about it last night during the broadcast, is the lack of mistake-free football was very concerning to me. You had, I'm not even going to get into the Tolles fumble, since I think that was a bad call on by the referee. The way I saw it last night is that should have been a targeting hit. So I'm not even going to count that fumble, but you look at a couple of things. First of all, the penalties on the offensive side of the football were really bad last night. You had like a legal procedure, I think, penalty to false start, some bad holding calls.
One drive where we had two first downs in a row. We were at the 50. We were at the field. And then there was those three false, I think it was two false starts. A whole all on that drive.
There was the goal line play on third and one and fourth and one, 1 yard to get in, and our center just gets pushed back. It looked like we didn't really change up the snap count, I think, enough on Clemson, since they looked like they had a beat on when we were going to snap the ball the entire night. You could see on that play, we just got leveled back our entire offensive line. So in my opinion, that goes both with coaching and an ability by the offense to just get some sort of push off the line. And beyond that, it was special teams. I guess there are no major complaints, but that's a game where you have to win all three phases. And Noel did a decent job, but still, I didn't think that we really got... enough from what we needed special teams wise. I thought it would be important for us to have Willis, Rouse, one of those guys, even Michael Walker, break one loose in order to get us going on some offensive possessions, and that never happened. So there's plenty of work to be done on all sides of the football, at least in my opinion. I don't think there was any part of the game last night that I was like, yeah, that went really well, since there really wasn't.
Right. I mean, I mentioned it earlier, but you talk about having to break big plays to set the offense up in good field position, or at least get maybe even getting a special team score. The offense got inside the Clemson 25 three times in the first half, came away with 3 points.
That's unacceptable.
Yeah.
And that just goes to show like how Clemson was, I think, so willing in some sense to play bend don't break against us, because if you watch our team, you know, in the last year or two, you know, one of our biggest struggles is scoring in the red zone, especially getting 7 points.
Absolutely.
And they know that if we struggle with that, who cares if we get a couple field goals, since we also have struggled with the field goal kicking game. But even if we get a few field goals, that's not going to be enough to beat Clemson. We needed to get 7 on that first drive or second drive last night when we started on their 9, and then on the 3rd and 1, 4th and 1, you have to come away with 7 each of those times in one of these big games. If you're a more talented football team, you can get away with those mistakes, but right now we are lower level ACC football team. You have to play mistake free, mentally tough, physical against a team like Clemson, and I just didn't see that last night. We didn't play to our strengths. We didn't adjust our game plan enough. There's just so many ways that we could have corrected that performance to make it better. And as you mentioned, Anthony, it's like maybe if this is the first time this happens this year, I'm somewhat okay with it. Not really okay, but somewhat okay. But the fact that we lose to Virginia Tech 49-0 and then this 56-10 with our points coming mostly in garbage time, it makes me really, really concerned for the rest of the schedule, and doesn't give me much confidence overall that we're going to win any other game except maybe that UConn game. I think there's a real possibility we go 0-4 in the ACC again.
I mean, I just last night, all you really needed was to keep it at a two-possession game going into maybe the fourth quarter for it to be a really exciting game. And who knows what could happen with just a big play or whatnot. Like you said, Connor, you needed special teams. Who knows? Special teams could have got a really big play. And like, or it could have been another muffed punt or something like that.
Right.
And this time we just score on it. I said, I mean, we even almost scored on the muffed punt. It was at the six-yard line. I mean, we could have easily scored, and that could have happened again. But it just attributes to both sides of the ball didn't play up to the competition, because if they did play their absolute best and adjusted a game plan, maybe a little, not even adjust the game plan, but just play their absolute best, they would have been in that game. Though they would have been at make it. I'm rambling right now, but
it's okay.
They could have made that a two-possession game throughout the entire game. They could have stayed at two possessions if they played their absolute best on both sides of the ball.
No, and honestly, if...
I think it could have.
I think every BC fan's realistic. Last night would have been the upset of BC football history if we won that game.
I didn't expect a win in a two-possession game.
If we lost that game, say, 28-17, I am, like, totally happy coming in here today.
It's an impressive victory.
not a real victory. Moral victory against Clemson. Honestly, if we just covered the spread of 17 points, I would have been somewhat happy. Not incredibly happy, since I hate to accept losing, but just realistically, it just doesn't... There's no way that 56-10 should have been the final score of that game.
Agreed. Hey, well, yeah, one of the big things you hear a lot in sports, oh, there's no moral victories. You lost the game. Yeah, to a degree, I understand, and in some cases, that's true.
There's cushioning the blow.
But with the state of Boston College football right now, I think there are moral victories, and BC wasn't able to come away with one last night. And like you said, Connor, it makes me very concerned for whether they can come up with some of those later in the year. Now, I want to ask you guys this. What positives have you seen so far? Because I would say Harold Landry has absolutely been a positive. He's been...
Strahan's been pretty impressive, too. I mean, last night, not so much. He had the big face mask penalty, too, in the third quarter.
I would say... I mean, there are some positives. It's just you have to look for them. I would say Toles' decision-making is actually pretty good. I think he has threw a couple picks his first few games. Last night, I thought he overall played the game pretty intelligently. And the other thing I would say, I think Tommy Sweeney is really good. I like him at tight end. Him and Kalnin are a good hybrid sort of tight ends. They can block, it looks like. They can also catch the ball. So I've seen a little bit of an improvement this year with our receiving core, with those two and Jeff Smith, where I think we actually have weapons that we can go to downfield and catch the ball. Remember last year, I felt like that... Not only that, every part of the offense had a hand in why we struggled, including the receivers, which we've had difficulty over the last few years getting receivers who can just catch the ball. I've seen an improvement in that respect this year.
I mean, so yeah, I would definitely say Toles is a definite improvement. Maybe look for a quarterback more like that, because he is a graduate senior, I think, right? Right.
Yeah, graduate student.
So like, maybe look for quarterbacks more in that sense, in terms of a big guy with a, you know, more of the arm and ability to still run, because Toles can definitely run.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not a Darius Wade or what Tyler Murphy's speed was, not nearly that, but he still is athletic enough. He was avoiding sacks left and right last night.
Yeah, he had pretty good pocket presence.
Yeah, he had a good footwork last night.
Quarterback play, though, very concerned after watching Darius Wade last night, if that's what's in store for BC football next year. I know it's only a few plays, but that pick six, he was staring down his receiver the whole time on that play. And you have to wonder if his confidence has taken a hit in any sense, because he was beaten out for the job going into this year when he seemingly had the job last year. So I would say that Wade, in my eyes, is sort of a concern going forward, whether it's going to be him or Anthony Brown at quarterback next year, which I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I think either way, the quarterback position is going to be a question mark next year. But I do agree with your point about Tommy Sweeney. I've been saying for more than 3 years now that an offense like BC's needs to utilize the tight end more. I think he can be a weapon, safety net in the middle of the field, and I think we're doing that a little more this year, finally. Toles is finding Sweeney. Sweeney's making some plays, so I give him credit. I mentioned Landry. And I like Davon Jones at running back.
Yes.
Yeah, he was the best one by far last night.
Yeah, he goes ahead with the head of steam, yeah. And, I mean, he's taken all of the reps away from Willis and Rouse. Like,
right.
I thought there was going to be a three-headed beast with Hilleman and those two this year, but now it looks like Jones is even cutting into some of Hilleman's.
Because Hilleman hasn't been great.
No, he hasn't been great. No, I thought Hillman was going to have a Andre sort of year coming into this year, breakout year, and it just hasn't been that way. Once again, I don't know how much of it is the offensive line, but honestly, the offensive line has not been as bad as it was last year. I thought they've had some, especially last night, they got some push on the line on a couple plays. Obviously,
look at their goal line play, though.
Their goal line play was concerning. That was a backup center was in there for John Baker, which I think was a big reason.
Middle goal line of that.
He got pushed back. And Adazio talked about that in his post game presser. So I think that was partially Baker, but I thought pass protection, they've done pretty good job overall for Tolles. Tolles is combination of being very elusive, but I actually they haven't been a really the reason I think the offense hasn't gotten going this year. I think it's been a little bit of that, but it goes way deeper than that in my eyes. I think the biggest thing would be play calling. I didn't like the play calling for large portions of last night. I thought we played a little too conservative.
Too many draws.
Yeah. I thought the best plays we called were in that second quarter when we mixed in a reverse here or there, had Tolles roll out a little bit. And then we had the handoff or the play where Smith threw it to Tolles. I thought that was an interesting play. I think it only got a few yards, but
it
I'd like to see.
First down, though. It was a third down.
But yeah, you have to utilize like what you have as a football team. And BC right now, they have a few strengths. One of it they have going for them is they legitimately have two quarterbacks on the field at any time with Smith and Tolles. And Smith can run pretty fast. I don't know why they don't try to go maybe into the Wildcat a little bit more or do something like that with Smith, since I think it could bring a really interesting different look into the offense.
I mean, I just, again, going to the point with Tolles, I mean, last night, aside from the muff punt, I mean, he was put at the goal line. He had a chance to probably get 20 points for that offense in that game. They were in the territory. They had two touchdown-worthy drives of offense in the second quarter. And in the third quarter at one point, they were at the 30, and then the fumble happened. The Ben Bowler hit on Tolles.
Right.
And they were at Clemson territory in almost field goal range. So he did enough to get about 20 points on the board against a Clemson defense. So I thought that was very impressive. Also, I think he's been actually a positive of the team overall this year. Despite the scores of each of the big ACC games we've had, I still think he's been more of a positive than ever. I mean, combined last year's defense with this year's offense, that would have been a very good team, I think.
Yeah, I think this year's offense is like
talent-wise
sufficient, and you could see last night they had a couple bright spots. I actually thought the offense was somewhat of a pleasant surprise at points last night in the first half and that second quarter. Once again, if we played the second quarter all four quarters, that would have been like a 13-10 game in my eyes. Both sides of the ball were playing pretty well. We got some momentum going downfield. It was a really tough, competitive, physical game in that second quarter. But the problem is just keeping that consistent play. So we have a bye week next week, and then we have Syracuse coming into town. What do you guys think about Q's? They've had some struggles themselves. They had a coaching change coming into this year. Do you think that BC will be able to get the monkey off its back? Because for me, this is the game that they need to do it in.
I would agree with you there. Just looking at what Syracuse has done this year, 2-3, big win over Notre Dame, lost to Notre Dame.
but it was a very close game, that's what I was saying, yeah.
They played Notre Dame well, I should say. Yeah, I apologize.
Back to moral wins.
Exactly. Blown out by Louisville, lost to South Florida, their wins have been over Colgate and UConn being a close game. This Syracuse team really doesn't scare me at all. They have an ability to put up points, yes, but I think if we get any sort of BC defense performance like they're capable of, then I think this is the game BC can do it. However, given what I've seen the past two ACC games, I really am hesitant to say, yeah, this is the game BC is going to do it. And I would love to sit here and tell you, yeah, I really believe that BC wins this one, but I can't say that.
Yeah.
I can't.
Yeah, you just can't at this point in the season. And as I said, every game's a question mark for me. Even that UConn game is starting to, which we all thought would be a surefire win, is starting to rear its head a little bit more, as UConn is no Buffalo or Wagner. They're a Division I school. They play in not really a power conference, but a legitimate enough conference, and they're a Northeast rival. So, Jake, what do you think about the Cuse game?
I mean, all points have been completely accurate. You need to get the defeated ACC monkey off your back, and it's due. Time is due, and Syracuse is a team to do it. I mean, it's all about the mistakes they make, the same exact mistakes that happened last night against Clemson. Giving up the big plays, not making your tackles, missed assignments. And, I mean, if the offense plays the way they did last night, honestly, for the most part, I think they'll stay in the game offensively, because I still don't see Syracuse putting up, even if the defense is playing almost near level of last night, Syracuse isn't going to run up a board nearly close to that. So I feel like the game will obviously be closer, or rather I should say should be much, much closer. But it just the way the team has played against Virginia Tech and Clemson when they faced their best competition, even Georgia Tech, because mistakes lost that game also. From a mental standpoint, who knows where the team is at? And that's why I think the bye week is probably the best time, and it could have been.
Yeah, I do think it is coming at a good time. I think last year BC was really hurt by the fact that the bye week was so late in the year, probably as late as it can be, and the team was clearly just limping down the stretch. I mean, the defense was trying to carry the whole team on their shoulders and clearly was showing signs of fatigue before they got to that bye week, and then they were able to come out of it and play very well against Notre Dame. But I think it comes at a good time, and I think it's time to do a little soul searching if you're BC. It's time to really look at this schedule and say, if not now, when? Because, like Connor said, the rest of their ACC games, two of them are winnable but on the road, and the other ACC home game is Louisville. And then there's UConn, which is a non-conference game against an opponent that is not a pushover. So, yeah, if not now, when?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I'll wrap up a little bit of our BC talks. Unfortunate state of BC football right now, 3-3, with the loss to Clemson last night. We're going to take a short break here on WZBC Sports, Sports Saturday. You're listening to 90.3 FM Newton or at WZBC.org. When we come back, we'll talk a little NFL and a little MLB playoffs. Stay tuned.
Sunshine on my grease, like a child could swim in my skin. Waterfalls, matted hair, buzzer mouse drum under there. You can drown me in a storm, let the waves wash me away. Oil spill on the sea. Take a sip, it's up to the right, it's